I'll introduce myself. My name is Rich Anderson. I live in Cambridge, Minnesota. I'm a Lutheran minister and a individual marriage and family counselor and direct a chemical dependency treatment program in our hospital. I'm curious here, how many people in the group have somebody close to you who is chemically dependent? Okay. How many people here at least have known somebody or spent some time with somebody who is chemically dependent? Okay, so it's just about everybody, I guess. All right. I was real uncertain about what to do with the topic. Most of you saw the movie yesterday, and most of you have had some experience, and I'm sure different degrees of experience with the disease. I thought I'd run through a few primary items, and then I thought we'd talk about a couple interests, subjects, that things you want to talk about and sort out. The place I thought I'd start, first of all, is I would like you to tell me what you think an alcoholic or chemically dependent person is. And how can you tell someone who's chemically dependent from someone who isn't?
Yeah. Someone who can't stop. Drinking.
Somebody who can't stop drinking. Okay. Any others?
I guess I'd be more apt to say one who, as far as alcohol, cannot drink in moderation.
Okay, someone who can't use their chemical in moderation, or their drink their alcohol in moderation.
Yeah. I don't necessarily agree with that. I've seen alcoholism that, you know, you just see people drinking and they don't appear, you know, out of control or anything. If that's what you mean, I don't mean
that. No, I don't mean that, that they necessarily are in a state of inebriation.
Oh, I see.
But I mean, you know, their idea of drinking is not like one drink a day.
Okay. They drink excessively? Mm-hmm. Or?
Yeah, and they may be on the wagon for a while.
Right, aren't there binge alcoholics who drink for a period of time and then
And then stop for a while?
Stop for a while and never stop.
The guy lived
with us,
they did that.
Okay.
Drink,
but you're trying to say something different than they can't stop. You're trying to say they don't stop when they start?
I'm trying to say that I think they can stop some of them. They can't drink in moderation. They're not controlling as such. Drinking isn't probably what they want it to. No,
I heard the word control several times. Okay. In the conversation.
That's what I put. Can't control their drinking. Is that close?
Well, their drinking controls them.
Right. Yeah. Spend their life controlling when they're going to have the next drink.
All right. Drinking controls them. How else can you tell?
Aren't they using alcohol or chemicals for the wrong reasons? Like they're using them to hide in or to escape?
Okay. They use a chemical as an escape? Or for other reasons that are destructive and harmful?
In the case of chemical, maybe they're dependent on it, whether it's sleeping pills to put themselves to sleep, or it's something else to get them going.
Yeah.
Okay. Could you read that last thing that you wrote there again?
Use chemical as escape or other negative reasons. For the wrong reasons.
There's never any right reason for it, is there?
Mm-hmm. I think, too, some people say that wine at a meal adds to the aura of the environment of the situation. For some people, maybe the word negative or maybe right or wrong reasons be something it'd be best to steer away from. I think one of the real problems with the whole disease and the whole area is that for many, many years, there was a lot of moralizing about drinking, and that's a real difficult thing that a lot of people who are chemically dependent have now, is the whole moralizing wrong, bad, awful, terrible kinds of things about it.
Yeah. Okay, isn't it just someone that can't face reality, the things that go on around them, getting hurt or something like that, by
the drink? Difficulty facing reality?
Yeah.
Or can't face reality? Okay.
Can't relax from alcohol. Maybe that's the same. We've got other reasons. I don't know.
How about if we put use chemical as an escape or to relax?
Okay.
Go on wine.
How about use chemical for any reasons? To have fun or to, depend on chemical.
Now that I scratched negative, we've got other reasons. Okay. You had a question.
Well, I guess this is more of how we can tell a person's an alcoholic when their life is just so unmanageable. They can't, manage to, nothing goes right for them.
Okay, everything starts getting screwed up.
Yeah.
So does that mean that somebody who loses control of their drinking, but everything's going fine in their life? Isn't chemically dependent?
Yeah.
Okay. But you do see lots of unmanageability problems going on in the lives of many alcoholics, chemically dependent people. Okay. Unmanageable lives. Let's try to get down to some real nitty-gritty particulars. How do you draw the line between somebody who's just a social drinker and somebody who's chemically dependent?
Higher tolerance.
Increased tolerance?
Increased tolerance.
You want to explain what increased tolerance is to people?
They can drink other people, their size, under the table.
Under the table, okay.
Not true in all those stages on the left. Maybe when you get to the chronic, then they don't have a tolerance.
Oh, that's
what I read it.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is that the guy who goes out picnic and they're playing ball, and everyone else has had two beers and he's had eight, and he seems just like everybody else. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's a sign. Okay, that's increased tolerance. Greater volumes of consumption with less effect of intoxication. Sure.
Alcoholics, they may be able to control when they drink, but not necessarily. They can't control how much at one time. Versus a heavy drinker, he knows when to cut it off before he's. Well, not that he won't get drunk, but that he's not fit drunk, and he has to drink until he passes out and drinks.
Okay. So the fellow who says, well, I know when to quit, I'll show you, I'll go out and have three and quit, is not an alcoholic?
No, there really is a chemical reaction in the body to an alcoholic, and he has to have more to satisfy his chemical need.
Okay, I don't know for sure that there's a chemical reaction in the body that craves or makes the alcoholic have to have more. But you are right that for some chemically dependent people, they get to the point and they're lost. And they'll tell you, I know after my second drink, I'm going to have 15 and I have no control. That's the other half of talking about unmanageability in the first step of AA, and that's powerlessness. That alcohol controls and has power over their behavior. rather than they themselves having power over the alcohol.
Usually if you see the sort of self-tests of, you know, are you an alcoholic, but there may be listed a dozen or 15 or what things, and mm-hmm. you normally say, if you say yes, I don't know, four or five, whatever it is. So obviously, everyone doesn't have the same problem.
Right.
And that's why it's hard to list them, because what's true for one may not be true for the other one.
Right.
And then to me, there's always that gray area of when does habit become dependency.
Mm-hmm. Sure, and when is a heavy drinker addicted?
When does social drinking become more than that?
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
That's the gray area between what's social drinking and what's alcoholism.
And a lot of them, you're talking about use of drugs, obviously drugs used for I don't know how long for medical reasons. But the ones that may be initially given for medical reasons can also become
addicting. Sure. Yeah, many, many, many people are addicted to prescription drugs, and when they found out they were addicted, didn't believe it. How could I become addicted? I took them just the way my doctor said, and they did. Still become addicted to a doctor's prescription.
Well, this may be part of control, but they deny or hide their drinking.
Certain amount of denial. Refusal to admit to, honestly. Okay. Part of what Agnes is saying is true, that it's very, very difficult to try to lay out some real specific, definitive terms when you're talking about people that are all different. let me say a few things that I threw up here. The four basic words that describe chemical dependency or that are always used are these four. The one I think that's very significant is that it's a disease. Even today, a good 30 years after the American Medical Association said this is a disease, lots of people don't think it is. Many, many people don't want to believe that chemical dependency is a disease. But it's a disease because the AMA says it's primary, it's progressive, you can lay out its steps as it moves along, it's chronic, and it's fatal. And for those four reasons, the AMA says this isn't just a psychological thing. It's a very basic medical disease that can be treated but never cured. Can be arrested, but never, once a person has it, never removed, disappeared, gone away. Nobody gets cured of chemical dependency. Lots of people recover from the destructiveness of it, but live forever with the disease.
Could you explain primary?
Okay. Probably the best example I can think of is somebody who is chemically dependent saying, well, the reason I drank was that my wife and I are having so many marital problems and we fought all the time. And of course that's just a rationalization to support the denial that, well, you may have fought a lot and you may have decided to go out and drink afterwards as an attempt to cope with your anger or frustration. But once you became alcoholic, the reason you drank was because you were alcoholic and wanted to drink some more. You didn't drink because you and your wife fought.
It's a primary motivation in life.
Nothing makes you become an alcoholic. Once you're an alcoholic, your alcoholism is there. It's a basic core disease. It's a real difficult thing with kind of between the disciplines of the chemical dependency treatment people and certain fields of psychiatry. So a lot of fields of psychiatry want to talk about it as character disorder problems. They want to cure alcoholism by giving other kinds of chemicals, or they want to use antabuse, or they want to use shock treatments and many other kinds of things. And course, we argue that like crazy and round and round and round and go. Any other ideas or questions about what the four words are talking about?
Well, as a disease, does that mean that those of us who have alcoholic parents, we have that disease, or is it?
No. No, my grandmother had diabetes, but my mother didn't get it, and neither did I. At least not yet.
Okay.
My mother has arthritis now, but I don't have it.
But we
at least not yet.
It. Are the chances of our getting it are just statistically higher than? Because they don't they say that, you know, those of us who have parents who are alcoholics have a 50% chance of getting that?
I think yesterday after the movie, I quoted the study at Washington University about children born to at least one alcoholic genetic parent and adopted out at birth to parents that were not alcoholic at all, and 40% became alcoholic by the age of 30. I don't think from that you can conclude that if you have one alcoholic parent, you've got a 40% chance of becoming alcoholic yourself. I don't know what you can conclude from that study. I think if you grew up with one practicing alcoholic parent, there are a lot of reasons to be concerned about the effect that had on your very important developmental years. Some of the things that we're starting to work on now are programs for children of alcoholics, education and treatment for children of alcoholics to learn to recover from the effect of living in that environment.
Is it more weird than other people going there? Is that weird? I mean, what are you saying?
Is it more weird?
There's just the problems that those people have adjusting to life, is that what you're saying? Because they were, you know, lived in an alcoholic setting?
Well,
different dynamics, maybe in
a
family relationships.
Yeah, many of the really, really painful things that children of alcoholics experience are the role model stuff of no communication of emotions and feelings, violence and anger, running away and escaping rather than facing problems and working them out. The problems that you get when dad comes home drunk and mom and dad fight and scream. The incidences of physical and sexual abuse are very, very high in families of alcoholic parents. Lots of those kinds of things are inflicted upon the members of the family that live in that situation. Lots of struggles with feeling responsible, feeling I've got to fix and change. In the movie yesterday, the little girl was growing up just like mom. You know, once mom was getting worse and worse and worse in her codependency and her depression, she came along and said, "Mom, you and I can solve problems together, right? I'll help." So she's going to take over. And she's watching mom and deciding this is what has to be done in the situation, learning to be codependent, watching the role models, picking that kind of behavior up. Maybe growing up thinking, if you've really got some problems, slug down 3-4 drinks and let the chemical give you a little vacation so you don't have to feel the pain or think about the problems and let them go away. And so learning to, the way to deal with problems is to escape them. And those kinds of things don't work forever. We're currently working with adolescents who are growing up in those kinds of family environments and are becoming adolescent codependents, who really are somewhere along the road of, for many of them, hitting the fork in the road where their codependency is a part of all they've learned about coping and dealing with life. And now they're at the age where chemicals are coming into their life in their peer culture. And they're beginning to experiment with different kinds of chemicals and mood-altering chemicals. And it's amazing how many adolescents in chemical dependency treatment were adolescent codependents first and couldn't stand it, weren't coping well with their codependency, weren't recovering from the pain and the agony of it all, and found chemicals a great way to escape it. Became chemically dependent as a way of attempting to cope with their codependency. So one of the things in a preventive sort of way we're trying to do is help adolescents learn to cope positively with their codependency with the hope that they won't choose chemical dependency as an alternative.
Isn't it like a lot of other things, whether it's divorce or it's abuse or it's this or it's that, you may not like it, but you learn it.
Yeah.
But you know, your best chance for a happy marriage is both of you had happy married parents, because you learned it without even realizing it,
mm-hmm.
without having to go through all the struggles of being not what you should do.
Yeah. The difficulty with a lot of children in chemical dependent families is they don't get a lot of support from their parents if their parents are actively practicing their diseases. If their parents are in recovery, they get tons of support. Why would that be? That's right. The guilt's just incredible when they finally sober up and realize what's been happening. Let me
is
go on.
It true that if somebody's in recovery from alcohol and actually only goes through the AA or the actual stopping the drinking, the disease of the diseased family or the family that's dysfunctional continues on until someone goes actually into therapy and begins to work on their emotional recovery?
I believe that's true. And I believe that you can take an individual out of their family system who's chemically dependent and put them in a treatment program, sober them up, run them through treatment, and if they grab onto a recovery program that they want to work, they can go back out and work their recovery program. But they're going to be swimming upstream if they go back into their family system that in a surrounding kind of way was codependently addicted in their whole dependency problem together. It becomes very, very difficult for that person to maintain their recovery going home to a family that didn't do anything.
But don't a lot of the programs now require family participation
or treatment centers? A lot of them offer educational things. Only a few of them require it. At least in Minnesota. We have an outpatient adult program, and we require at least one family member to be in codependency therapy. And we do codependency therapy, not family education. We believe that there's a certain amount of learning and education that can happen, and we provide that, but there's also a lot of group therapy and individual therapy that codependents need themselves to sort out and help themselves work on their behaviors and their thinking. And so our codependency program is as structured and therapeutic as our chemical dependency program. It's just as long. They spend just as much time on an outpatient basis as the one in chemical dependency treatment. And we tell people if you don't bring a codependent in here for codependency treatment, when you want to come into chemical dependency treatment, go somewhere else. We're not going to pretend giving you something and sending you back home. And there's lots of other places they can go. They can go inpatient for 28 days. They don't have to go outpatient for 5 weeks.
I've never heard the word codependency. Could you explain the word, how you use it, what it means?
Anybody want to? The question was, she's never heard the word codependency. Would we explain what that means? Anybody have a real good explanation they want to share?
Yeah. When a person lives in an alcoholic or lives with an alcoholic, their behavior becomes affected by that alcoholic, and they begin to focus on the alcoholic's behavior. They first start up with the drinking, and they realize that's futile. Then they worry about covering up and helping, enabling that alcoholic to function in life. So they become so good at functioning around the alcoholic, just walking on eggshells whenever he walks in the room, and they check his behavior, and they're all focused on his or her activity, that they become as sick as the alcoholic, only they're addicted to the behavior of the alcoholic, not the alcohol.
So they actually are addicted to the alcoholic's behavior and become
as sick as the alcoholic.
In a certain sense.
Well, that's very interesting. I think very accurate, but I've never heard it explained.
Yeah. And there's a lot of other kinds of characteristics that we can identify. And I think I'm going to do a workshop next week on codependency. In a certain sense, the chemically dependent person becomes their focus, like she said, and the codependent all of a sudden realizes, I've got to protect this person from getting hurt and the consequences of their behavior and keep this whole family afloat, keep the kids from getting hurt, cover up here and there so the kids don't feel bad about their dad. And in the movie yesterday, you know, dad won't read the funnies to me. Oh, you know, your father's had a hard day at work and he's tired and he needs, we can do it, you know, ourselves. All these kinds of excuses. The one I love in the movie was when she was out in the backyard and was going to paint the birdhouse and he stopped out and made some, he said, what are you going to do? And she said, I thought it needs a new coat of paint. And he said, good, cover up all my mistakes. How gorgeous. You know, it's the perfect thing. A codependent covers everything the alcoholic, chemically dependent person does. Calls in. She kept calling in, making excuses.
I think it's not only important for the chemically dependent person not to return to an untreated environment, but it's so vitally important for a codependent person. I've had my experience of death in a codependent person within 6 months of a chemically dependent person changing their behavior, stopping their dependency patterns.
Yeah.
And the person lost their central reason for
it. Yeah, their whole reason to live.
Yeah.
That's the interesting part, is the codependent becomes addicted to the chemically dependent person needing them.
Yeah.
I need you to need me. I need to mother you so that I have some reason to live and exist. Their whole self-image is caught up in taking care of the chemically dependent person. And then, if he doesn't need that anymore, well, what good am I? That's next week's presentation, if you're here. I want to run a few things by you. One is, interesting way that the Johnson Institute in Minneapolis has used to describe developing chemical dependency is that they talk about there are three different states. There's normal, there's euphoria, isn't that a town in Washington?
Yeah, I know.
Eastern
Washington.
Yeah, not west.
Okay. And there's pain. People are born and live in normal. People who initially begin using chemicals find that, especially with alcohol, they find that if you have one drink, this is what it feels like. If you have another drink, this is what it feels like. It's predictable, it's controllable. I know if I go out and have two drinks, I'm going to get this kind of a sensation in general. After a while, they may decide to try a couple drinks and they'll feel a little bit high. They'll get a little sense of euphoria from the chemical. And then as the alcohol is out of their system, they come back to feeling normal. As adolescents and young adults begin to experiment more, they decide, well, you know, one is good, more is better. My personal philosophy is anything worth doing is worth doing to excess. They find out as you experiment, if you drink a little bit more, you get a little more euphoria, a little more high, and then you return back to normal as the chemical leaves your system. Well, this whole pattern can continue, and many times as it progresses, the chemical use progresses, and it's still really social drinking. The whole cycle of going up to euphoria and coming back to normal becomes something that people become very comfortable with, very used to. They know how to control it. They feel at ease with it. Then what may happen is sometimes if you're, something may happen and you'll drink too much and wake up the next day with, you don't return to normal, you return to a little bit of pain. But not too long and you come back to normal again. But then again, you may decide, well, I like this euphoric feeling, but then you may return to normal, you may come back to a little bit more pain. As the whole disease progresses to become eventually a disease, this whole cycle begins to shift. And pretty soon, it takes more as you're drinking, you've got to drink more and more to feel euphoric, and more often than not, you come back to pain before you get to normal. And as tolerance increases, it takes 8 drinks to feel as high as it used to when you drank 4 or 3. And so you've got to work harder to get up to euphoria, and your chances of coming back through pain are greater and greater. Eventually, what happens when the disease becomes prevalent is your cycle ends up down this way. Chemically dependent, the chronically alcoholic drinks to feel normal, and when they're not drinking, they're living in pain. And the whole cycle is they no longer use their chemical to feel euphoric. They can never get that euphoria anymore. They use their chemical to feel normal, return to pain. Then they use their chemical to feel normal and return to pain. And the whole cycle shifts away from euphoria and back down to pain. Now for many of the chemically dependent people that we see on our outpatient adult unit, they're pretty much in a stage of euphoria, pain, and normal. You've got to be fairly chronic in your disease to be drinking just to feel normal all the time. But it's very fascinating how many people actually just need 1-2 drinks a day just to feel normal. Many people who are into 1 or 2 drinks a day just to feel normal, kind of a cycle, and very likely could be chemically dependent. Now the interesting thing that we've been tossing around is, where's the line between social drinking and chemical dependency? How do you decide who's alcoholic and who's not? I'm lucky enough in our treatment unit to have a secretary who's worked with us for about 4 years now and grown up in an alcoholic home and has an alcoholic husband and has gone through the whole process of recovery and everything, so that we really don't need to use the extensive diagnostic procedures we go through to determine if someone's chemically dependent or not. I just say, hey Arlene, how's the hair in the back of your neck? Okay. She knows. She can just sense it. We joke about it, but I know there's something to it. That she can spot characteristics, looks, behavior, all that sort of stuff across the street. Now, you know, it's playing the odds game and she's got to be wrong on them, but question is, and we divide it up this way. We say that there's a whole area of being non-chemically dependent where people don't use, and there are a lot of people who don't use mood-altering chemicals, and there are a lot of people who use mood-altering chemicals socially. Then there's a line somehow, and I don't think it's a clear line, it's kind of a hazy area, where you enter into the disease. And we divide the disease up into early, middle, and chronic stages. I think we talked yesterday about
What images do you get taught? What do you see? What are you told is an alcoholic or a chemically dependent person? What do we usually get projected to us?
A bum.
Skid Row bum? Yeah. Somebody who's really chronic. Anybody see the, what was that movie that had Lee Marvin, and he was a lawyer, and just a year ago or so he was a trial lawyer of some sort?
The Verdict?
The Verdict. Paul Newman. Yeah, Paul Newman, okay. The Verdict. Well, the guy was pulling his jug out of the drawer all the time, drinking all the time, and drunk and in the bar constantly. Well, it's okay, but the difficulty with that is it gives people the impression that, well, he's obviously an alcoholic, but then people expect to see that kind of behavior in people who are alcoholic. And if you don't see that behavior, then what does it mean?
They're not.
They're not alcoholic. Sure. And so we get a lot of people coming into our unit for evaluation. Court ordered in, lawyer sends them in, family services send them in, they're applying for a license, or they're going through some kind of process, marriage counselors, whatever, and we run them through a whole series of tests. We've computerized a lot of questionnaires, MMPI, 3-4 different interviews. It takes about 6-7 hours to do a full evaluation. And then when we sit them down and tell them where we see them, we try to describe that our tests come out and say you're at about this point in the continuum. And you are chemically dependent. And they say, well, how can I be chemically dependent? And then they come out with, I don't drink every day. You know, or I only drink beer. I don't drink in the morning. Or, you know, I don't have to drink. I can quit. All right. And so, you know, they have thoughts and ideas, expectations about what an alcoholic is, and their behavior isn't like that. An interesting comment we hear from a lot of people is, well, if I'm an alcoholic, all my friends are. And all I can say is, probably right. Part of what we do to make this decision, and I think this is a pretty important decision to make, are you chemically dependent or not, because it's a diagnostic determination about a disease. And if you're wrong, the person's got the label. If you're right, the person's got a very chronic and fatal disease that they need to address and do something about. There is a manual out called the DSM-3, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, number 3, third time they've reviewed it. And under substance abuse disorders, alcohol, dependency, basically DSM-3 says you have to be able to demonstrate a pattern of pathological use. And then they give you 8 different things that they say demonstrates a pattern of pathological use. And you can go through a lot of different drinking experiences or problematic behaviors or regular use of dialing. They also say in order to demonstrate dependency, you have to be able to prove tolerance and or withdrawal. Now what's interesting there is tolerance, as we talked before, on the upswing means that it takes more, you've got to drink more to feel the same euphoric. Your body becomes more tolerant to the chemical, so after, rather than having 4 drinks and feeling high, it takes 6 or 8. As the disease progresses, this guy down here, you know, probably gets drunk on 6. This guy here probably gets drunk on 8 or 10. This guy here gets drunk on how many?
1 or 2.
Why?
Liver won't handle it.
Right. The physiological damage to the body, as you get more chronic, the body won't process it. The liver won't process the alcohol. The damage gives you, all of a sudden, rather than increased tolerance, decreased tolerance. And you get so much destruction physiologically that you can't process it anymore. And one or two drinks gets you as drunk or as high feeling as five or six down here. So we get a guy in at this stage who says, how the heck can that cop pick me up for a DWI? That machine must be wrong when it said 0.14. I only had two drinks. Well, we do some liver function tests and tell them you're almost dead. I had a fellow a couple years ago who was in the hospital, and he came in after being picked up on his way home from work and got a DWI, which is driving while intoxicated in Minnesota, with a blood alcohol level of 0.16. And he came into the hospital, they drew his blood, it was 0.16. He couldn't figure it out. He said, it's impossible, those cops are picking on me, somebody's setting me up, you know, they're trying to cheat me. What's going on? And I said, well, when was the last time you drank? And he said, well, last night I had the last beer about midnight. And I said, so then it's been about 18 hours since you had your last beer. How many did you have before that? Well, I came home from work at 6, and I probably had 12, 14. And then I said, well, you know, you've been through treatment three times before. This is your fourth DWI. What does that tell you then about your body's ability to process alcohol 18 hours later? There's so much physiological damage as a result of his progressive disease that 18 hours after he stopped drinking, he was still illegal to drive a car. And he thought, well, I got up in the morning, I worked all day long, I got in the car and drove home, I hadn't drank anything, how could I be illegal? And what he realized was that he'd get home by 6 o'clock, probably still at 0.12, 1.4, 1.6, and start drinking again. He was never sober. And he'd been doing that for 4 or 5 years. He said, maybe I don't know what it's like to be sober. And then he got real scared about going into DTs and detoxification and all that stuff. That was a real interesting experience for him and me. I learned a lot from that.
I got over the trauma nurse at a place where they bring all the people in jail. Said one night for the heck of it, she averaged up, and the average rate was 0.35, and she had one with a 0.20.
Is that enough? Depends on what kind of what system they're using too. Because
I don't know what happened.
Minnesota, if you're 0.5, you're dead.
Well, she said normal people would be dead.
Yeah, okay.
But it proves simply that that person is tolerant to alcohol.
Yeah. Yeah, so incredible. I mean, I think, you know, you might as well take it straight out of the bottle if you get a 0.5. Just to...
Mark? What kind of cultural things do you come up with it? Because I'm... To some extent, I have a feeling that Scandinavians have a lot of trouble with it.
Yeah.
Or it's partly due to some stories that I've heard about, I think this is maybe a couple hundred years ago, when they started brewing. Farmers put almost all their grain into booze. And the king actually had to put a tax on it to say you cannot brew more than this much, or they would have put all their food into alcohol.
That's sort of a side thought, but you know, if you think about the starvation in the world, and you think about all the food that goes into booze, there's no reason for there to be any starvation in the world. But the cultural kinds of things, I'm 100% Swedish and Lutheran and grew up in Minnesota, and I think the stuff that I was taught as a child was deprivation of emotional expression. I had no idea what feelings are all about. You know, I never, little boys and boys don't talk about emotions and feelings or express them. And all there ever was okay and mad. How do you feel? I'm okay. Oh. Or how do you feel? I'm mad. That's it. And I either punched somebody's lights out or everything was okay. So that sort of stuff, you know, and the stoicism of being, no matter what you feel, don't show it on the outside, stuff it and keep it to yourself. It's okay to have a couple beers, you know, the guy who's out drinking and carousing, that's what guys do. I've heard a number of parents who had their kids come in the hospital and we're detoxifying them, and we call them and tell them to come in, and we say, we have your child in here and he's drunk and we're putting him through detoxification. Oh, thank God he's not on drugs. It's socially okay. You know, all guys go out and get drunk once in a while. That's just part of being a young American boy. It just sort of perpetuates that thing of use chemicals to change how you feel so you don't have to deal with how you feel.
I'm not acquainted with DSM-3. I have some acquaintance with Keller's 90-day control test. Do you have some opinion about that 90-day control? Pertinently, do you know it? And how trustworthy do you think it is?
I don't remember it very well. Would you refresh it?
All right, he says you determine your daily drink limit, and for 90 days you see if you can live within that daily drink limit. His opinion is, and he wants you to have therapy along the way, his opinion is that if you stay within that limit, no matter what your drinking patterns may be, you're probably in control of your drinking and not, therefore, chemically dependent.
If you drink 6 a day.
Pardon?
What if you're drinking 3 to 6 a day or something like that?
He would say, if you set your limit and stay to the limit.
Well, I'm sure that John Keller is very reasonable about it. He's one of the pioneers in the area. Sure, he wouldn't say, well, you know, I'm not going to let you get by with a case a day as your limit.
Yeah.
But I would guess he'd say, you know, what do you think's your limit? 3? Never drink more than 3 for 90 days? Maybe you're not chemically dependent today. Difficulty is, it doesn't mean that you aren't going to become chemically dependent in a month or 2 months or 6 months. And I've used similar sorts of things with people that I was sure were chemically dependent and they were denying it. And I would say, okay, how much do you think you can drink and stay there? And they might say, well, 4 drinks. You know, I can control my drinking and never drink more than 4. And so I'll tell them, well, for the next 3 months, can you never drink more than 4? Sure, no problem. Or what does it mean if you do drink more than 4? Well, then I can't control my drinking. Fine. As soon as you find out you can't control your drinking, come on back in. And usually within 90 days they come back in. Or you get them to make a contract, and you maybe write them out. It says, if I ever drink more than 4 drinks the next year, or 2 years, 3 years, I will do such and such to address the problem. I will admit it's a problem and get some help. Then you just let them go, fall on their face, you know, and hope they don't smash up a car or something. Roger?
Yeah, I've heard that on a talk show or something, I've heard quite often that it's possible for alcoholics to be able to go back to social drinking after they've been through the process of cure and this type of thing. That's really hard for me to believe, but there is that, you know, that's being discussed out there and saying it's possible, and that really bothers me a lot.
Yeah, you know, that goes back to the Rand report way back in California. There are different camps. And I happen to be in the camp that says, you're talking out of both sides of your mouth to say that you're chemically dependent and you can be a social drinker. It's like you're saying, well, I'm here and I'm here. You can't be on both sides of the line. And I don't believe chemically dependent people can go back to social drinking. Well, what it does is it gives people a little bit of hope that they can hang on to their denial and that they don't really have a disease, and that after I get through this treatment, I can go back and have a couple. And they may be able to have a couple for a little bit, but after a while, again, they're going to lose it.
Do you think that some of that comes from maybe misdiagnosing and going into treatment, and some people that are perhaps in the gray area and go through treatment and then perhaps drink afterward and don't develop into a chemically dependent person? That perhaps that could happen, but at the same time, why take the risk? And why, I mean,
I think it does a real disservice to people who actually have a disease and don't need more help to perpetuate their denial. Mark?
Well, I heard a study just before I came up here that has been done on that, and they had taken a group, and the percentage of people who could control after having gone through treatment and been alcoholic, it was something like 3-6%, which is pretty low. The rest of them could not handle it. So.
Yeah. And I know some specific personal cases of people that I'll bet my life are chemically dependent. But they've decided to do what we call white knuckle it. You know, they're hanging on all they can. And they're also very angry. And they're into what we call a dry drunk syndrome. And that is that their behavior and their relationships and their communications are the same as if they're drunk, but they're not using the booze. And they're really miserable, difficult, impossible, ugly, ornery people to try and live with. And a couple of these fellows use going out and having a social drink or two every once in a while as a way of shoving it right up their wife's nose, proving to them, say, you said I was an alcoholic and I had two and I didn't have any more. That proves it, see, and I told you so. And it's just a real angry, hostile kind of dry drunk syndrome problem. And so I think there are some alcoholics who can have one or two out of sheer anger and bitterness and resentment and never have any more like that and do it just every once in a while, and it serves a different purpose. But they're not happy. They're not living whole, complete, growing, serene lives. And I sometimes wonder if some of them aren't going to be murdered.
Can you comment on marijuana and cocaine abuse as chemical abuses? You know, yeah. They manifest themselves the same as alcohol, or is it different type of denial?
Okay. marijuana and cocaine are two different categories, and they're two different drugs. And what can I say? DSM-3 doesn't identify cocaine as addictive. Doesn't say that you can become cocaine dependent.
No.
DSM-3 puts tolerance or withdrawal in here, because you don't get withdrawal from marijuana, but you can establish tolerance of marijuana.
Yeah.
Treatment in general is pretty much the same. It's basically being willing to admit that you're powerless over alcohol, that your life has become unmanageable. The mainline core treatment programs deal with the 12 steps of AA and work a person through that process. But marijuana and cocaine have other different social kinds of characteristics. The cocaine milieu is just a really interesting liturgical experience. You know, the whole thing of preparing the drug and lining it up and all the things that go into the cocaine culture. The cocaine addicts that we've had can just get high talking about preparing your drug and doing it. The marijuana thing is something that's really prevalent among kids, and not too sure what to say. It's not
addictive-wise, dependency-wise, it's not much different than alcohol, but it's got its own little subculture and its own little paraphernalia things and its own little language. And
so they are just sort of social stratas of acceptability. If you're doing the marijuana or the alcohol or the cocaine, you kind of have your own little identity or something.
Lots of times, sure. But it's very interesting with things like marijuana, lots of people don't know somebody's high.
Yeah.
Lots of people can't tell that they're high. Kids get high and go to school.
Yeah.
Slip out at lunch and get high and go back to school, and teachers never know it.
Well, even if teachers suspect it, there's nothing they can do unless they can prove it to be preferred or limited.
Oh, but you can bring a kid in and take a blood test and prove it.
Marijuana. I just know that that's what the teachers say at school. What are we going to do about it?
Yeah. You bet. Codependency next week. Oh, by the way, Judy Madison has a book in the bookstore about alcoholism, and it's got some good things in it if you're interested.